Well, I've been asked to speak on the subject of why bother with the Christian faith. And to be honest, in some ways it's a subject that's autobiographical, because I thought as I grew up as a teenager, if there was anything worth bothering with in life, it certainly was not Christianity. I had a number of views of the Christian faith, all of which sadly were negative, which would have led me to say, look, whatever is worth bothering about, it's not the Christian faith. My first view was that it was boring. My mother, who was known affectionately in the family as the Ayatollah, used to take us along to church. And actually, my family, it's quite interesting. I've just got back and I've just realized what a matriarchy my family is. My father has only made one decision, I think, in 47 years of marriage, and that's to recognize Angola as a sovereign state. Anyway, my mother, known as the Ayatollah, would take us along to church, and I literally would sit in church, and I can remember I just used to count the bricks up the wall until I went out of focus. Then I'd start again. Don't do that now, please, because it'll put me off. But anyway, that's what I did. Just count them up the wall. Noel Edmonds once said, church is the most boring experience on offer, and I could just relate to that. Secondly, it wasn't just boring, it was irrelevant. I couldn't see what relevance this book, written 2,000 miles away, 2,000 years ago, had to me. I just couldn't get that. It seemed to me just a list of do's and don'ts I didn't need to keep hearing. I found it profoundly boring. In fact, I found it so irrelevant to me that I used to leaf through it looking for references to rugby. We had scripture lessons once a week. And I used to sit there thinking, right, I'll try and find rugby references. And I found a number I was pleased with. One to referees in John 9 verse 1. I knew a man blind from birth. I thought that was quite a good reference. One to prop forwards, what I was myself in Exodus chapter 30. A stiff-necked people, I thought that was quite good. One to heavy tackling in Acts 20 verse 26. It's better to give than receive. I thought that was quite good. And then one to foul play in Acts 13 verse 3. So Paul and Barnabas were sent off. And that was basically, that was the result of 4 years of scripture study. I just didn't think it was relevant. The next issue was, I guess this is more serious, I didn't think it was true. I somehow had a picture of Jesus Christ, I mean this is blasphemous to say, but it's the truth, as a sort of, I can't bear to say this really, but as a sort of long-haired hippie in a nightie floating around the Holy Land. I just thought he was 6 feet up in the air above contradiction with a nice sort of still yellowy beard, and that was him done. And somehow in my mind, I'd mixed up Winnie the Pooh, the great Limpopo River, the three wise men, and Jesus walking on the water. They were all in there together, and it was a sort of world of make-believe from the nursery. And at school, we used to sing, and did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's pastures green? No. As far as I could work out, he never came to England. It was just a world of make-believe. So it was boring, it was irrelevant, I didn't think it was true. And lastly, the other issue were the clergy I met. They all seemed to me to be a bit like Rowan Atkins in Four Weddings and a Funeral. They were just terribly wet. I can't believe I am one now, but I mean, to be honest, I'm one because I got a third at university. I remember when I got my third, I thought, that's guidance, it's the Church of England for me. It was the only career option available if you get a third. When I got my third, I said to my tutor, was I close to a 2-2? He said, no, Rico, it's a very solid third. So here I am, an Anglican clergyman. But the issue with the clergy, you know, I mean, they just were such drips. And I was in rugby circles at the time and trying to prove I wasn't a drip. So I spent my time doing things like this. And I didn't know many clergy that could do that, you see. Actually, that's really concussing me. Anyway, you know these things, these are crushable cans. I've got the most beaten up car in central London. It's a Ford Fiesta 1.1, and I drive around the West End, you know, up around there on Portland Place, and I stop at the lights, and someone very glamorous comes up and looks across at me with someone very sort of rich, and they're both sitting in the car, and they look disparagingly across at me in my car. I look across at them, crushes on my head, and as we drive off, I've won. So that's why I have it. This saves me about £65,000 on a car, this does. It's even better if you've got a dog collar on at the time, I must say. Anyway, I use it because actually, you know, it's very easy to deceive people. And as I saw the Christian faith as boring, irrelevant, and untrue, as I saw the clergy in that way, I was deceived. And there was one person, I guess, who really made me bother about the Christian faith, and that was my godfather. It wasn't a very, it left me cynical, but it did make me think. And he was the one, I think, who led me to faith in many ways. And the reason was, on the 6th of August, 1982, he was killed in a cliff fall very suddenly. In fact, I have a picture of him an hour before he died, surrounded by his family. He had 4 girls, and they're all looking at him adoringly. They're off on a yacht together. He went for a walk. There was a tree that had fallen across a cliff path. He tried to climb round the tree. He slipped, and he fell to his death. And no one in my family had any answers to his death. As a clergyman now, you stand at the graveside And you say these words from Psalm 103. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field, but the wind blows and its face remembers it no more. And the brevity of life hit me for the first time. Billy Graham, the speaker, was asked, what has most struck you about life? And he answered, it's brevity. It's brevity. And I had no answer to my godfather's death, and I mourned him deeply because I loved him. And the issue about loved ones dying is that they're hard to come by, people that love you. And this man did love me. I was like the son he hadn't really had. We had a huge relationship. Suddenly he was gone and there were no answers. And the issue that I faced was, Rico, do you have a philosophy of life that copes with life at its broadest point? In other words, at the death of a loved one. And the answer was no, and nor did anyone in my family. So that was a huge paradigm shift for me, my godfather's death. But secondly, the issue was not so much his death, but actually, what was the point of his life? What was the meaning of it? And as a 16-year-old, I had no idea how I started reading this passage from Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I wonder if you can pick it up. But it was so formative for me. It's written by King Solomon, a man who had the money and wealth and time to seek meaning in life wherever he thought it may be found. And you see what he says, verse 3, end of that first paragraph. I could just echo this. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few, I knew they were few, my godfather was dead, days of their lives. And Solomon, as he sets out on finding meaning, begins by saying, I know meaning in life is from pleasure. So he sets out on a pleasure-based life. Can you see that as we look down? Verse 2, laughter, I said, is foolish. What has pleasure accomplished? So he says, well, I think life's about just having a laugh with your mates. And that is true. It is good to have a laugh, but that can still leave you empty. There's a verse in Proverbs chapter 14. Even in laughter, the heart may ache, the heart may weep. And we can know that. I was involved with the suicide of a guy who 48 hours before he killed himself had been the life and soul of the party. So there can be a laugh, but you can still be empty. So Solomon moves in a pleasure-based life from laughter to drinking. He says, I'll drink my way out of it. So he says, can we see verse 3? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. He just says, well, let's just go out and get smashed. But actually, he says, my mind's still guiding me with wisdom. I think that means he woke up and had a dreadful hangover. And so what was the point of that? So he moves from laughter and drinking to sex. Verse 8, can we see middle of the next paragraph? I amassed silver and gold for myself, the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women, singers, and a harem as well. We know that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, Solomon. So he took sexual pleasure to the end of the road, but he found the paradox of pleasure. The more you have, the less it satisfies. So Solomon then moves from a pleasure-based life, and he says, it's not that. He says, I know, the meaning of life is my work. He says, I will make my mark by what I achieve. So he says, verse 4, can we see as we look down? I undertook great projects. I built houses myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks, planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. So he builds and he builds and he builds. And the result of all this work is verse 9. Can we see verse 9? I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. So I think this would be the case now. I think if Nelson Mandela walked in here now, I think most of us would stand and we'd say, well, I think, you know, 28 years in prison for his people, he's one of the great men alive. If he walked in, we'd say, well, I think he's the man. Well, Solomon, as he walked into any room, people said, no, that's the man of the generation. He is the man. And yet, despite all this work, despite leaving his mark, he says, can we see verse 11, yet when I surveyed all my hands had done and what I taught to achieve, everything was meaningless, the chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. If today, just as you were walking in here, you saw me out on the street and I was just running around in circles and I came in to speak and someone said, well, Rico, what have you been doing? I said, I've just been chasing the wind. I think you wouldn't bother listening. You might not want to bother anyway. I did get a third. But you'd certainly not bother then. And Solomon looks all he's done and he sees the London cycle. This is the London cycle. People set their goals. They achieve them. They feel euphoria, but then there's an emptiness. Goal, achievement, euphoria, emptiness. Goal, achievement, euphoria, emptiness. And it's all over modern autobiography. Michael Caine, what's it all about? Here's how he ends the book. Bob Geldof, is that it? Just having raised so much for Live Aid. Is that it? Is there not more? Kenneth Williams, who died about 100 meters from here, lived in the parish, who, I don't mean to swear, but who concluded his autobiography, these diaries, on the day he died with the word, oh, what's the bloody point? Barry Humphreys, the guy Dame Edna Everidge in Legend, who begins his autobiography here, "More please, I always wanted more, I never had enough. There was always a sense that there must be something else. Goal, achievement, euphoria, emptiness. And I could relate to it, and I could see it in my godfather's life. I'll be happy when? Just, I'll be happy once I've got the O-levels done, once I've got the A-levels done. Well, once I'm in my gap year, once I'm earning, once. Jack Higgins, the author, was asked, what do you know at 60 you wish you'd known at 16? And he replied, I wish I'd known that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. So you see, that's the first thing. There's the issue of death. Secondly, there's the issue of meaning. And thirdly, from my godfather, there was the issue of selfishness. You see, after he died, my godmother opened up his wallet and found a list of mistress's addresses. She was so distressed by this double life that she decided there'd be no funeral. So there was no grieving point for the family. His ashes were thrown over the side of his yacht with a bottle of bourbon. And I was suddenly struck by the fact that this man who I really worshipped was not the man I thought he was. But nor was I. You see, at that time I'd kept this diary. And I have to say that the reason I kept this diary, 1981, I'd kept it through that, was really because I thought I was such a great guy, I owed it to the world, the future generations, to all of you, to record my life. So I kept this diary, and I found out it was a total burk. It was very depressing. What I found was that, you know, on the one hand, I'd call for world peace, but on the other, I'd never lay aside the weapons of malice and sarcasm I used in my own self-defense. On the one hand, I'd say, it'd be brilliant if the world was fed, but on the other hand, I would ask my parents for a larger allowance. There was just a lack of correlation between life and lip in my life, in my godfather's life. I read years later some words in the book of Romans where Paul says of his own life, I don't do the good I want to do. No, the evil I don't want to do, this I keep on doing. And there is something wrong with the human condition. Why is it we hurt the people we love most? Why is it so hard to keep good things good? What would it be like never to have lied? What would it be like never to have entered a conversation with the sole aim of enhancing myself? What would it be like never to have envied? It was Gore Vidal who said, every time a friend of mine succeeds, part of me dies. What would it be like not to be feeling that? And Winston Churchill said this, I think these are striking words on the human condition. He wrote this in the 1950s. Man in this moment of his history has emerged in greater supremacy over the forces of nature than has ever been dreamed of before. He has it in his power to solve quite easily the problem of his natural existence. He's conquered the wild beast. He's even conquered the insects and the microbe. There lies before him, if he wishes, a golden age of peace and prosperity. He has only to conquer his last and worst enemy, himself. And the 20th century unanimously failed to do that because 3,000 people died violently a day, 165 million. So those were the three issues that I faced personally, but I could see around me, death, meaning, selfishness. And I have to say the Christian faith didn't at that time offer, I thought, any answers, although I had begun to go to a voluntary 9 p.m. communion service at school, and to my embarrassment, it was only because there was a very attractive girl called Emma who went, and I used to like watching her walk up the aisle to communion. I don't think she realizes that she's the reason I'm now ordained, but anyway, there you have it. I never really spoke to her. I'm just psychologically screwed up, I suppose, but I used to like to watch her. And one day the chaplain said something which was by far the most significant thing said to me in my school days. He said this, who is this man who in the Sermon on the Mount says, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, and then as he's being murdered, cries out of the people killing him, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. And I suddenly realized that in the life of Jesus, there was this correlation between life and lip, which was so distant from my godfather's life and my own diary. And I then began to find that it was amazing that the person of Jesus began to walk off the pages of the Gospels as I went to a tiny school Christian group, a tiny group run by a math teacher. But he hit head on these three issues I faced. Issue number one, death. I realized, amazingly, that on Easter Day he rose from the dead. So he lived and taught and had a band of followers. And then he was tried in a Roman and Jewish court. He was put up on a cross and crucified. He was certified as dead. He was put in a tomb, and 3 days later, he was walking around again. And the historicity of that is backed up in the creed. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. On the third day, he was raised from the dead. What do you think of that? But you see, here's the issue. If Jesus got through death himself, then he has the power to get me through. And the coffin is not an exitless box. That's the amazing truth that we have there. So as I take funerals, and I take many, I stand at the back of church and I say these words from Jesus. I am the resurrection and the life. In other words, Jesus says, when it comes to your death, or indeed the death of a loved one, will you trust me with your death? I am the resurrection and the life. Will you put your hand into my hand? And that was an amazing source of peace for me, because I was troubled by death, and I no longer am. Secondly, the whole issue of meaning. Well, here's another autobiography. This is Tolstoy. And his whole book, he says it's a confession, he calls it, was a search for meaning. He said, I spent my whole life looking for meaning. He said, first of all, he said, I thought it was in wine, women, and song. And as a young soldier in Leningrad, I pursued that. It was gratifying, but not meaningful. He then said, I thought there'd be meaning in wealth, and I inherited my father's estate, became one of the wealthiest men in all Russia. He said, again, I could do great good, but still there was a hollowness. He then says, I decided it was in fame, and then you've got one of the coolest lines in literature, because he writes, so I wrote War and Peace. You know, one day I wrote this book, and he said, wherever I went, I was just known as a great man. He said, well, I was greeted as that, but he said, still there was an emptiness. So he said, I know, it's in marriage and a family. And he writes, in 1867, I married and had 13 children. And he writes in brackets, this for a time put me off finding the meaning of life. But one day, he's watching his little boy playing, and he suddenly cries out in existential angst, what meaning is my life that the inevitability of death does not destroy? He knew that his little boy would one day be dust, and it fills him with a sense of being a piece of, I guess, DNA stranded in the universe. And then at the end of the book, Tolstoy writes, he says, as he watched a peasant farmer live, he says, and he quotes Jesus' words in Matthew 11:28, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And certainly for me, as I try to find the answer to verse 3, can we see the end of it? I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I found the answer to that was in relationship with Jesus Christ. Suddenly I found that as I tried to live with him, which I did hopelessly, but as I tried to do that, that was where there was meaning. Augustine wrote, oh God, you've made us for yourselves, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. What is the answer to goal, achievement, euphoria, emptiness? It's that we're made for a relationship with the God who made us. And central to that relationship is just the third issue. I found Jesus Christ hit death head on, he hit meaning head on, but thirdly, he hit selfishness head on. And that's central to how we find this peace. You see, this diary wasn't just the fact that I was cornered by my conscience. The bigger issue in this diary was that Jesus Christ had been utterly ignored. And I'd used and ignored God in his world. Taking the gifts of God, family, friends, food, falling in love, fitness, whatever it is, but pushed away the giver. And I hate it when people do that to me. And I found that there was in the Bible a day of accounting, a day of judgment, which means how I treat you matters to God, and how you treat me matters to God, and how we treat the world matters to God, which I hope you'll agree is a super thing, because as we go through life and we meet people who treat others badly, we want a judgment to come. But I found there was a day of judgment, and on that day of judgment, either I could pay for my sin myself as I stood before the God who made me, or I could allow Jesus Christ to pay as he died on the cross. So the cross wasn't just a Galilean carpenter dying. At the cross, Jesus died in my place for my wrongdoing. That may sound so extraordinary, but that's the heart of the Christian faith. It's as though here I am, and here is my wrongdoing, cutting me off from God. So I pray, but the prayers bounce off the ceiling. And here is Jesus dying on the cross. And the Bible says, all we like sheep has gone astray. Each has gone his own way. But the Lord has laid on him, on Jesus, the wrongdoing of us all. And when I realized this book could be forgiven, I can only describe it as like taking off a massive wet rucksack. The joy of finding peace with God. Well, let me finish there. And can I say, as we think about why bother with the Christian faith, all of us, at one time or another, face issues of death, meaning, and selfishness. And could it be that the person of Christ is the one who meets us and is the answer to those issues? And amazingly, he's paid for the answer. When it comes to our death, he's risen and will get us through death. When it comes to meaning, he comes into our life to meet us. When it comes to selfishness, he died that we could be forgiven. And our only hope is that you'll unwrap that gift. That you'll say, well, look, this is a gift from Jesus Christ. How can I go through life without this anchor point? So please, I guess we're saying, make time to, in the diary, in the file of facts, whatever it is, to for once try and make the important come before the urgent. And I know we're always overwhelmed by the urgent. So I guess Jago and I'd want to say, please make time to investigate him. Because if it is true that he does meet those issues head on, then actually he's not just our servant. We're to be his. And to ignore him in the world that he's made is a serious thing. It's a serious thing. So our prayer is that you'll make time to really look through that, and perhaps experience of death, meaning, and selfishness will cause you to say, I'm going to have to bother with this. We'd love it if you did that. We'd love it if you made time.